Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show, and thank you for listening. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Big surprise. You can breathe a sigh of relief. Young Cyrus Simcoe is back.
I'm sorry to break it to you, Chad.
Yeah. Hey, how was your week, Cyrus?
It was phenomenal. My wife and I celebrated 20 years of
wedded
marriage.
Bliss.
Wedded bliss, yes. That was great. We went,
and it took you a whole week to celebrate too.
We took 3 days to celebrate.
Nice.
And it was choice. I do suggest you try it if you have the means.
If you have the means. You're talking to Al Frohman, the sausage king of Chicago.
That's right. What, you got that. That's
whatever good. His name was.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, it was awesome. We stayed in downtown Chicago, and we went to the Laugh Factory, so I saw some stand-up comedy. We went to the Planetarium, went to the Shedd Aquarium, where they're doing this special, you can walk around while you're drinking wine. So we were there for about 4 hours.
Tell me more about this aquarium.
It was amazing. It was amazing. But anyway, we have a show to do.
Yeah, well, this is part of the show. Part of the show. Hey, Thomas did a great job. Thank you, Thomas. Well done.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas.
He's a good apprentice, and but it's good to have you back, Cyrus.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
You had an email that came in from somebody about you, and I shared it with you in the last day or two. Do you want to share that? And
oh,
say
it was
thank you?
Really nice. Yeah, I don't have it in front of me. I didn't know
I
you were going to.
I have it in here somewhere.
Of course you do. Yeah, you can share it if you'd like. But thank you to whoever wrote that.
Yeah,
that was really
let's see.
Nice.
It was, you know what? I thought I had it in front of me, but I don't. So we'll get it. And maybe after the next break, we will read it. Welcome again, 888-914-9149. Let's talk to Christina now in Madera, California. Hi, Christina.
Hi, good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
Hi. Oh my gosh. This is the first time calling.
oh, no problem.
But, I have kind of two questions for you. The first question is, my husband and I have been watching the series The Chosen, and I was just wanting to get your opinion or your take about the show.
Well, you know, it's come up a few times, Christina, on the program, and people have asked me, but the actual fact is I only saw the first episode. So I can only go on that. I'll share some thoughts with you. None of them negative. Everybody I know, like my grown kids, those who have watched it, they really like it. There's a lot of enthusiasm. So I haven't really talked to anybody who doesn't like it. Everybody seems to really like it. And that's good. If the story of Jesus is interesting and attractive to people, so much the better. What I saw that first episode didn't move me one way or the other. I wasn't wild about it, but I thought it was fine. The only thing, as I recall, because it's been over a year now since I saw it, but the only thing as I recall was there was a scene, I think it was toward the end of that episode, where Jesus, this is when St. Mary Magdalene is coming out of her life of sin and prostitution, etc. And there's this one scene where Jesus comes up to her and he puts his hands on either side of her head, sort of holding her head in his hands. And he comes close to her and he says, "You belong to me." Now, theologically, I understand what's going on and I endorse that because we do belong to Jesus. And in the sense that I'm sure that they meant it, I have no problem with that. But it was the way it was done that I found a bit unsettling because it had all the appearances of a romantic moment. It wasn't a romantic moment. It wasn't intended to be a romantic moment, but it came across as though, almost as if he was going to kiss her or something like that, which obviously wouldn't have happened. So other than that one, what I felt to be misstep in the way they characterized this relationship, between Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and not having seen anything after that, and only knowing the positives that everybody is saying, I have nothing negative to say about it. But that's really all I can say because, you know, I haven't seen the rest of it. Now, have you seen it? And if so, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So last night, my husband and I, we started seeing it about a month ago. So right now there's only two seasons. And we saw the last episode of season two.
Okay.
And before watching it, like you say, a lot of friends of ours, people we know that are really excited about it and, oh, you should watch it. And So we're like, okay, I know it's been out for, like you say, about a year or so. And so we hadn't really thought about watching it until people started telling us they thought it was really good. So we
did
watched
you have,
it.
Did you have some reservations about it or were you just curious what I thought?
No, we were just curious about what your thought was about it. We enjoyed it. We really liked it. And so I was just thinking, I told him, I haven't heard anybody, call you and ask you about it. And so, I just get to hear your show probably about the first hour and a half every morning. I try to, get on and listen before I head out to work.
Thank you. What do I need to do to bump it up to 3 hours a day, Christina? Just asking.
what do you need? Well, I'm from California.
It's early. I know it is. But you know what? The upside to that is that you can listen on the Relevant Radio app at your leisure. Anytime that's convenient for you, you can catch whatever you missed. But no, first of all, I really appreciate the fact that you listen for an hour and a half. That's wonderful, and I'm grateful for that. So, yeah, I would say that you're probably the sixth or seventh person who's asked me about this over the last year or so.
Okay.
And I give pretty much the same answer. I give a qualified thumbs up. It wasn't something that I personally was, like, really lit up about, but I am happy if there's any depiction that's faithful and accurate and respectful, any depiction of Jesus that's going to draw people. So that much I'm really appreciative of.
Yeah, and I looked at the extra things that they have on there, like where they call the round table where he has, he does have a...
You know what? Your phone is kind of doing crazy things, Christine. I'm getting about every other word now. Well, I hope that's helpful to you, and I'm glad to know that you liked The Chosen. And everybody, as I say, that I've talked to seems to like it as well. So a lot of them seem to love it, so it's gaining a lot of popular support. And that's good. Thank you. Let's go now to Barbara in Los Angeles. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. I just wanted to share something, and I don't know if it's been talked about on your show yet or not.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so many years ago, I believed in abortion, and if I had ever gotten pregnant, I probably would have had one. And then I had a conversion experience. Someone showed me the video of Dr. Bernard Nathanson's Eclipse of Reason.
Okay.
So in that video, now this was many years ago, they showed a baby doing an ultrasound during an abortion. And so step by step, they showed the baby's reaction. You know, the heart is beating very calmly. Mm-hmm. And then when the placenta is punctured, its heart starts to beat really fast.
Yeah, the original movie was called The Silent Scream. And they incorporated that into you're referring to. Yeah, I'm familiar with it. It's horrible.
Right, right. And so when I saw the video Eclipse of Reason and the baby's reaction, then I went, oh my gosh, that's killing another human being. Like I didn't realize that a baby, that I just didn't realize inside would have been a baby.
Yeah.
I just didn't have that mindset. And so when I saw the baby's reaction, then I went,
okay. I want to ask you a question, but I don't want to get in your way. So please continue, but I do have a question for you.
Okay. So anyway, so that totally horrified me and changed my stance on abortion, and I became pro-life. But I wondered, now this was many years ago, and then I kept wondering, well, now they have 3D, 4D videos of babies and, you know, ultrasounds.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, well, why don't they show that now? And then I heard that it became illegal to videotape a baby during an abortion. And I wonder who was behind that.
Anyway,
and why are they hiding it? And so I was thinking if people had a more informed
opinion or more informed information about what happens to the baby, not just the mother's situation, but the baby, then I think a lot of people in the country, in our country, would change their minds if they could see what it actually does to the baby. And so I don't know if there's anybody out there that knows about, you know, legally how to change that so that it can, you know, so they can show people what happens.
There are.
But that.
Yeah, there are. So you'll be happy to know.
So yeah, so that's. Yeah, I just wanted to say that that was what changed my mind. And I think it would change a lot of people's minds if they could, if they had a chance to see what really happens to the baby.
I agree. Now, you'll be happy to know there are organizations. One that I'm more familiar with is called OBRIA, O-B-R-I-A. And they specialize in this. They do. They perform other services for women who are contemplating abortion. And they have the state-of-the-art equipment so that the woman can see what her baby looks like in these ultrasounds. And they're one of a number of organizations around the country who are really working hard to make sure that these ultrasounds are as available as possible. For example, like a mobile clinic in a big bus that would pull up across the street from the abortion clinic, and it has the sign that says free ultrasound, you know, see what your baby looks like. And a lot of babies are saved that way. So I'm with you. It's an important thing, and I wish there were one of these parked in front of every abortion clinic in California, New York, and Illinois, and all the places where they're ramping up their support of abortion. But here's my question for you, Barbara. You mentioned that when you saw, you know, when you saw Eclipse of Reason and you saw that section from The Silent Scream, which was actually, little side note here, Bernard Nathanson did not record that to be pro-life. He wasn't even pro-life at the time yet. He just was performing abortion after abortion. He was performing thousands of abortions, making money hand over fist. And he thought it would be interesting to see what is going on in there because, you know, the doctor can't see. This is all internal. So he arranged to have these small camera introduced so that he could record it for scientific purposes. And then what he saw is what began the process of turning him into being pro-life. So that's the genesis of that. Now, the question I had for you is, you mentioned that you didn't realize it was a baby or that you realized that this is a baby. What did you think it was in the time when you were pro-life or pro-choice, pro-abortion? What was your idea of what that was during an abortion?
I had no idea. I just would have thought I was just all about me and get it out. You know, like I can't do that.
Right.
So it's like I was just so self-absorbed about my life and what I wanted that I didn't, and I was also young. You know, I was also young. So I didn't have any concept of, about it being a baby. I just didn't. I just thought about the inconvenience of it. But I mean, thank God I never had to have one. Thank God I never did. But
yes, thank God for that.
And I just wanted to go back to your point about having these ultrasounds in front of abortion clinics. But what I'm saying is that there needs to be an ultrasound of a baby during an abortion. It has to be made public so that people can see what is actually happening.
Yeah.
You know, showing the baby while they're alive, you know, that would be beautiful, and I'm sure it could change people's minds. But if they see the baby's reaction during the abortion, that would change people's minds.
I agree. I think, and I don't know, so I'm not sure what to say about the illegality or whether it's illegal or not, depending on the state, I guess, to have an abortion or to have an ultrasound during an abortion. But I agree with you. That would be very difficult to see. But some people who don't believe that that's really an unborn human being, they need to see it. Anyway, Barbara, thank you. And I'm so happy to hear that as you look back on all this, the one thing you don't have to deal with is knowing that you did have an abortion, as many women are still grieving that and still in pain for that. So I'm glad at least that you don't have to carry that with you. And thanks for the call. And for those who are listening right now who are grieving an abortion, you know, maybe more than one even, the Lord loves you and he will forgive you and he will help you learn to forgive yourself. Whether you're the mom or you're the father, there's healing in store for you. There's healing that the Lord wants to give you. So if you've been staying away from church, maybe because you're feeling guilty and ashamed, go back to church. If you've been staying away from the sacraments, go back to the sacraments, starting with confession. Make a good confession, and you can begin that healing process. And there are organizations around the country, two of which I'll mention to you. One is Rachel's Vineyard, and the other is Project Rachel. They're not the only two, but they are two prominent organizations who help women and men heal from abortion. And there is a real process that you can go through, and you will find healing, and you will find a cessation, or your feelings of grief and self-reproach will begin to subside, because you'll know that the Lord has forgiven you. So if that describes you, or a daughter or a sister or somebody you know, who, or a brother or father for that matter, who's in pain right now, be sure to encourage them to check in with a group like Rachel's Vineyard or Project Rachel and start that healing process. The Lord wants to heal you. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, before we go to the next phone call, I know we have a break coming. I believe you found that email from the listener that I think it would be nice if you read.
You want me to?
I do, yeah.
All right, I blush with compliments. I'm not used to this stuff. All right.
Yeah, you're all bright red.
I am.
Bright red.
Okay, I will read this. This is from Jen. Thank you, Jen and Madison. She says, Cyrus, I was a huge fan of the Sean Harriet Morning Air show, and I remember how highly he spoke of you online, and I always thought the guest list was incredibly diverse, interesting, and edifying. I came away from his show never failing to learn something about my Catholic faith and enjoying myself immensely. I can understand the pressure you were under to book all those amazing guests, but your skills made that show the great gift it was for the years you and Sean ran it. Thanks so much. I love hearing you and Patrick, and you are totally the coolest team.
You're blushing.
I love that you do. Sorry, I love that you do not want to be involved in all the online stuff, and I feel the same way. Jen, thank you.
That's
Jen.
That's sweet. All right, very nice. You have something in your eye, Cyrus.
Don't do that to me.
Wipe your eye. Oh well, yeah, and you know
these are the nicest listeners.
They are.
I got I got a tweet from Sarah, who is with Morning Air, and she's like, "Hey, we're getting calls from people that want to know if you've been fired or like what happened to you because I wasn't here on Tuesday and Wednesday."
Well, when that rumor started up, nobody believed it.
So I tweeted out, "Hey, I'm celebrating 20 years with Melanie," and I was bombarded with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people saying congratulations. I had no idea that was going to happen. Yeah. I was like, oh, I'll let people know since they seem to be, they're calling in to see where I am. I'll just tweet something quick.
And oh, yeah, they loved it.
Yeah, so my wife and I were just scrolling through all of these congratulations. And just the most wonderful listeners. The Patrick Madrid Show listeners are so kind and loving and generous and supportive.
I agree. I concur.
Yeah, you guys are the best.
I concur in spades. Well, he's still blushing, everybody. But you deserve it, Cyrus. Welcome back. And again, Thomas did a wonderful job. No disrespect to him. Great job. And it's good to have you back. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with more of your phone calls. I'm also going to talk about yesterday's horrible assassination of the Prime Minister of Japan, or former Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe. I'll talk about that in an angle there that I want you to know about. I'll be right back right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
By now you've heard the tragic news of the assassination yesterday in Japan of Shinzo Abe, who was, I didn't know this, but he was the longest in office of Japanese prime ministers. And a man came up behind him while he was standing at a podium in the middle of an intersection in a busy city street, where he was about to give a campaign speech on behalf of a candidate who was running for some office. And this man walked up behind him and using they're calling it a homemade gun, and that's what it looks like, because it looks like it's two tubes tied or put together with duct tape. And he wound up shooting him at least once in the neck and once in the heart. And I couldn't tell, based upon the descriptions, whether or not the wound that pierced Abe's heart was from the back or the front. And it doesn't really matter, because he died 67 years old. And he was not in office, but he was a very popular prime minister for Japan. And he also was very adamant to help not only the Japanese economy get out of the doldrums, but also to rearm and reconstitute the Japanese military so that it was no longer just a pacifist self-defense force, which is what the Japanese constitution after World War II required. They were forbidden, according to the new constitution that was imposed on them by the United States, that they were not allowed legally to build a military that could project force. Well, he was successful in changing that and was in the process during his time as prime minister to help basically make the Japanese military something that could project force, not just defend the homeland. So that's just a little bit of background about this. But the thing that I want to get to, and I give credit here to the Daily Mail, because they have a very extensive photo essay on the assassination with pictures. Thankfully, they don't show pictures of the actual moment of the assassination, but you see him standing there moments before this takes place. You see close-ups of the gun. You see the guy who did this getting tackled and all of the above. But there is something in this reportage that I thought was interesting and worthy of note. I wanted to share it with you. And that is, they had a section there about how very strict Japan's gun laws are. Now, this is maybe a backdrop to what we've been talking about in this country, not necessarily on this program, although we've dipped into it here and there. And that is the whole running debate over gun control and how it is at a fever pitch. Once again, because of all of the spate of recent mass shootings, including the one that just took place in suburban Chicago, well, north of Chicago, just over the weekend. So it's on everybody's mind. So listen to what the Daily Mail had to say in describing Japan's gun laws. Guns are extremely hard to obtain in Japan, and as a result, the country has one of the lowest rates of gun violence in the world. Getting a firearm involves 13 steps, the first of which is joining a shooting or hunting club. Those who want a firearm must then take a course in gun ownership with a written exam at the end before getting a doctor to declare them mentally fit. That is followed by a day-long course at a gun range on how to fire and store a weapon, and another test at the end, in which they must achieve 95% accuracy. Police will then speak with owners about why they want a weapon and conduct a background check that involves interviews with their family, as well as checks on their relations with neighbors and their employment history and their financial status. If they pass, potential owners must apply for a gunpowder license and get a certificate from a weapons store that allows them to buy a specific kind of firearm, with only shotguns and air rifles allowed. Then they need to buy an ammunition locker and a gun safe, which is inspected by the police, who do yet another background check. Once purchased, the gun must be registered and inspected by police once per year to ensure that it's being stored separate from ammunition and that both containers are kept locked. Licenses expire every 3 years, with owners needing to retake a written exam to renew it. When a gun owner dies, the heir must return the weapons. Each prefecture in Japan can have only 3 gun stores, and new ammunition can only be bought by returning old canisters to ensure that people are not stockpiling it. That is very stringent. And look at what happened yesterday. The guy apparently just built his own gun. So in spite of, and this is the part that jumps out at me, in spite of maybe among the strictest gun laws on the planet, we still see these kinds of heinous shootings. Now, this was not a mass shooting. It was an assassination. But it was a shooting nonetheless. And that gets me back to the question that I was ruminating on, and we talked a little bit about it. We didn't go very deep in it. And that is, if you juxtapose Japan's very stringent gun laws, where virtually nobody has a gun, and their crime is very, very low, let's face it. Gun crime is very low. They have other problems, like knife crime, people going into grammar schools and kindergartens with knives and killing a whole bunch of people. I don't want to dwell on that, but that's been a problem in Japan. So it's not as though, you know, gee, there are no guns, therefore nobody does any bad things. People find other ways of doing things like this. And in Japan, that's been one of the problems that they've had to deal with. So I return to my question, and we don't have to get bogged down in it, but I think it's the question that we have to ask ourselves here in the United States, and that is, what has changed in our culture and that has been a gun culture all along? For as long as the United States has been around, it's been a gun culture. For the reasons we've talked about, like if you were one of those who lived in a city, you were less likely to own a gun. But anybody who was living on a farm or out in the country, they had to hunt until the Industrial Revolution. And so this country has always had guns. It still has a lot of guns. A lot of people have guns. Of course, the Second Amendment and all that. So all of that being the case, something changed in the United States. And I'm throwing a dart by saying 50 or 60 years ago. I'd like to look at some statistics to see when did we see this sudden rise of mass shootings and the kind of gun crimes that we're talking about here. They had gun crimes back in those days, the olden days, but nothing like what we have today. Nowhere even close to the proportion of mass shootings and things that we're dealing with today. So what happened? It wasn't the guns. I mean, they were there then. They're here now. You may say, well, they're, you know, more powerful weapons. Maybe. Okay. That could be part of it. I don't dispute that. But something in the country has changed. And I don't know. I mean, I've been to Japan a bunch of times. Spent a fair amount of time there. I like the country a lot, but I don't have any special knowledge about Japan that would inform me about why this happened. It may have been just a like any other assassination. You've got this Lee Harvey Oswald guy who just doesn't like Shinzo Abe, and he figures out a way to get close to him and to kill him. It could be just that. Maybe it's nothing more than that. But the fact that Japan has such strict gun laws, it throws this question out there again, and that is that here in the United States, where we do have reasonably strict gun laws, why do we keep having these mass shootings? Now, I'm aware of a variety of opinions. Some people say it's violent video games and all of the guys. You notice it's not, you never see any women going out there and gunning people down. There may be an example of that. It's escaped me, but it seems like every single time there's a mass shooting, it's a man. And it's almost always a young man. You know, like in the 18 to 30 range. And I'm just theorizing here. I mean, isn't that maybe the bulk of the young men who are playing for sometimes many, many hours a day violent video games? Does that have an effect on this? I don't know. Some people are suggesting it. I think it's something worth looking into. What about the drug culture in this country? And not just illicit drugs. What about, you know, what are the long-term effects of things like Ritalin on boys? And so many boys nowadays, and have been for years, have been dosed on Ritalin because it just keeps them in line. What are the long-term effects of that? And is there any correlation between, let's say, Ritalin usage in young boys and into their adolescence and these guys who wind up doing these mass shootings? Is there a connection? Again, I don't know. These are things that we should really be looking into to see if we can find this. And there are other factors as well that people are proposing have something to do with the spate of mass shootings. I talked yesterday, just for a little bit, about the possibility of demonic influence. And that's also on the table. And it may indeed be a variety of many different things that are contributing to this. Excuse me. the pornography industry. And I don't want to talk too much about it, but I'll just say this, that there is an area of that world that fixates on violence. And if you've got young men who are immersed in that world and they're fixated on that particular kind of pornography, and many are, I can't imagine that that's not going to have an effect on that guy's psyche and affect the way he looks at people or the way he his attitudes toward people and so on and so forth. So if you're interested, this article in the Daily Mail, I mean, you can get it. I mean, if you go to any of the news aggregator websites, go to the Drudge Report, you'll find it there if you want to. But it's worth looking at because I think what they're bringing up about the strict gun laws in Japan, it must be part of our national debate on this topic if we're ever going to really get a handle on what's causing this. It's not the proliferation of guns, if you ask me. And I'm not opposed to sensible gun controls. Whatever is going to work best so we don't have people dead in the street, I'm okay with that. And I realize not everybody agrees with me. I don't want draconian measures. I'm not in favor of, you know, some of the more extreme examples of what people are concerned about. I am glad that we have our freedoms enshrined in the Constitution. But society has changed, and we've got to figure out how to pivot so that we don't wind up having these heinous mass shootings every week, every day, in fact. That's where I'm coming from on this issue. I don't want to see dead people anymore. So those are my thoughts. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Bernice in Graham, Washington. Good morning, Bernice.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
How are you? Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say that in answer to your question, my belief is in mid-60s, early 70s, we became a me movement in our society. I count, my feelings count, it's all about me. I think our society that we had prior to that was, we want to sacrifice for our country, we want to sacrifice for our family. Well, we see that that is changing primarily in American society. I see it. I don't see the love of country, the love of our parents, the love of our neighbors.
I can tell you why, Bernice, because in schools, especially the public schools, for decades and decades now, the children are being taught to hate this country. They're being taught that this whole idea of the United States as a great country, a shining beacon, that that's all a lie, and that the country is inherently racist and the country is inherently oppressive and that the country is really bad and you shouldn't be proud about it. And I mean, that's just one facet of what you're talking about. But there's been a systematic effort on the part of academia at all levels to not just shake the faith of people in this country, but to destroy it and to replace it with an antipathy toward the United States and in a deep root, a deep-seated suspicion and cynicism toward what we think of as American history and patriotism and things like that. It's been poisoned at every level in academia. That's a big part of why we're saying what we're saying.
But when we teach that and we teach people to dislike somebody else's opinion, dislike our country, dislike our neighbor, I mean, I don't know, you grew up in the same area that I grew up in. We used to have the dads would sit out on, you know, out on the porch or on the small little divider wall. I can remember the neighbors sitting there and we kids were playing in the street and our parents were there and everybody was talking. And we had the neighbors across the street had 7 kids. The neighbors next to us had 6. We had 5. And we were all just playing. And when we had a disagreement, whichever parent was out there would say, stop that. Have respect. Now, what I see, at least in the neighborhoods, are people come home. They drive into their garage. They close the garage door. They never see their neighbor. They never speak to their neighbor, except to say, I don't like that you're stepping on my lawn. I don't like that your dog peed on my lawn.
I have a reason for that too, Bernice.
That respect.
Yeah, I think there's one cause. It's not the only cause, obviously. And if you grew up in my era What you just described does not describe how I grew up. We lived in suburbia, and none of the parents were sitting on the front porches hanging out with the other parents. It was, you know, back in the 60s and into the 70s, it was different from what you're describing. But I don't doubt what you're saying. I believe you completely. But you probably remember a TV show called All in the Family. Remember that one with Archie Bunker?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Norman Lear, he came up with a genius way to subvert public opinion on conservative issues. For example, on traditional marriage, although that really wasn't even on the table quite yet. That would take another decade or so. But All in the Family is an example of a very popular, very funny, well-written, well-acted television program that had a very subversive effect because it portrayed the father, Archie Bunker, as this mean, grumpy, stupid buffoon. And he was. I mean, that was his character. And he was played brilliantly by Carol O'Connor. But that had an effect on the psyche, I think, of the television watching American public, and that is it became an archetype for the angry white male, especially father. He was unreasonable, he was prejudiced, he was all of those bad things. And that, to my mind, All in the Family, and I watched it and I enjoyed it, but I recognized later in life what it was doing. It became in itself a kind of archetype for all the other programs that followed. Think about Married with Children. I never watched it, but I was aware of it. And so many other programs on network television that portrayed the father as an idiot. He's a buffoon. He's not with it. He's dumb. And, you know, even today, when I hear people, you know, and very innocently, they talk about dad jokes and things like that. Even that is kind of a vestige of this intentional and systematic way of shaping public opinion against the idea of respecting your father because he doesn't deserve your respect because he's an idiot. And these successful programs wound up brainwashing generations of Americans without even realizing it into looking at dad number one and maybe to a lesser extent mom. And so I offer you that as a part of what I think is the reason for what you're describing today.
I agree. I can concur completely. And we had such respect and such reverence for our parents. I mean, even today, I still think about my parents who have now since passed, and I think mm-hmm. about what they taught. And I, in fact, my husband and I were talking about it last night. I had a very special upbringing, and I realized that my parents taught us to sacrifice, to give to others, even if somebody hurts you. Don't say anything bad about them. Say we differ in our opinion and walk on. Pray for them. I was always, if you don't like something or if you're somebody is hurting you, offer it up to Jesus. That was just part of our vernacular growing up.
You are very fortunate, Bernice, and I'm happy for you. I'm glad you called too. If only more people had the experience that you did growing up. Important stuff. Thank you very much. I will be right back.
Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. Didn't need no welfare state.
Everybody pulled his weight.
G-R-O-S, now red, great. Knows why
this hour is sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
It will probably come as no surprise to you. A new study was done that shows that neighborhoods that have more dogs see less crime. And you'll be able to read this article if you're interested. It's from Study Finds. We'll get a link posted to you for you on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. It has a lot to do with trust, researchers from Ohio State University have found, in which neighborhoods that have more dogs also experience less crime, including less murder and less assault. The study authors found that overall communities are safer when people have more trust in their neighbors. However, crime dropped even further in neighborhoods with high levels of trust and more dogs. Researchers say you don't have to have an actual watchdog to keep your street safe. Their results suggest that more people walking their dogs puts more eyes on the street, which discourages criminals from committing both violent and nonviolent crimes. People walking their dogs are essentially patrolling their neighborhoods, explains the lead author of the university study. They see when things are not right and when there are suspect outsiders in the area. You trying to take a bite out of crime, Cyrus? let's see. It was getting a little rough. It can be a crime deterrent. Hey, I saw some opportunity there. The Ohio
State
team.
Keep
teams,
you on a tighter leash.
Yeah. Yeah, that dog's a roofer. The Ohio State team says there's been a long connection between mutual. Let me try to compose myself. Between mutual trust and local surveillance among neighbors. That's what one of the earlier callers was talking about, trust among the neighbors. There has never been a good way to measure how residents watch out for one another and trust in communities. So they said, we thought that dog walking probably captures that pretty well, which is one reason why we decided to do this study. Researchers examined crime statistics from 2014 to 2016 for 595 census block groups. Those are neighborhoods in the Columbus, Ohio area. They also used survey data from a marketing firm, which found out how many residents had a dog in their home as of 2013. Lastly, they analyzed data from a adolescent health and development in context study, which measures trust in individual neighborhoods. Participants in that study rated how much they agree with the statement, people on the streets can be trusted. Results show that neighborhoods with higher levels of trust do indeed have lower levels of homicide, robbery, and aggravated assaults. This matches up with previous studies, which found that neighbors who trust each other come together when facing a threat. However, this study found one additional deterrent, dogs. Neighborhoods with more dogs saw their crime rate drop even lower than high trust areas with fewer dogs. Overall, trusting neighborhoods with more dogs cut their robbery rate by a third and their homicide rate by a half. That is pretty cool. And good news for dogs and dog lovers. I'm just waiting for you to fire up the dog voice again.
I thought maybe you had had enough of the dogs.
No, I was just waiting.
Yeah. You have dogs, right? You have a couple dogs.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a couple dogs.
I love having a dog. It's. Mm-hmm. I was always against it. And everyone in the family was like, let's get a dog. I'm like, no. And I finally mm-hmm. caved in. And this thing's great. I really, really like it.
Yeah. Now, if somebody comes to your front door and that person hears the booming bark of your dog, I'll bet you that makes them a little nervous.
Yeah, there sure is a lot of crime in this Chicago area. And mm-hmm. our little neighborhood is everyone has a dog, and a lot of them are big.
Yeah.
And our little cul-de-sac has no crime. So, my eyebrows raise when
you want to give out your
story.
Address?
No, thanks.
Okay.
No, thanks.
I had a bad experience with a dog. I like dogs. I really do like dogs a lot. And we've had dogs for many, many years. Really enjoy having them. But when I was about 12 years old, for my Boy Scout troop, I had to deliver some sort of a door hanger. And I don't remember now what it was for, but we had like a billion door hangers. We were supposed to go through the neighborhoods and hang them on the doorknobs of the houses. And I came around the corner because there was a house that was built where you couldn't really see the front door from the street. You had to kind of go around a wall. I came around the wall and I startled a collie who was just sitting on the front doormat. So I came around the corner. He wasn't expecting to see me, and I certainly wasn't expecting to see him. And he jumps up and he starts growling. He didn't really bark. He was growling and showing his teeth. And I made, that's exactly what it sounded like. And I made the classic rookie mistake. I did the wrong thing, and that is I turned around, and like a rabbit, I ran.
You ran.
I ran like a rabbit. And that dog chomped down on my left buttock.
Oh, no.
And broke the skin. There were fang marks in my buttock. And it made me afraid. I admit it. I was afraid because that dog bit me. And I kept running. Like, I was like Forrest Gump, you know, I just kept going and going. But I always
found dog attached to your buttock.
No, he got one chomp and that was it. Because I was moving, you know. But the thing is, I mean, it didn't deter me from loving dogs. I do love dogs. And we've, as I say, we've had dogs for many years. We have two dogs now. And so it didn't affect me in that regard, but it made me, and this is what I think it really did, is it made me nervous about dogs I don't know and dogs that don't know me. So I want to make sure that if I'm visiting somebody's home and they have a dog, I want them to see, hey, this is a good guy. I want them to smell me so they know who I am. I want them to realize, okay, this guy's cool, leave him alone.
Yeah, there is a proper way to meet a dog. And the first one is to ask the owner if is it okay if you pet the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put your hand out and let the dogs, if the owner says yes, you let the dog smell you first before you start, you know, giving him his scratchies.
Right.
Yeah, and you're careful,
supposed to, but, and you have to talk to them too, right? You want to give some verbal cues.
Right.
The tone of your voice. Dogs can tell a lot about you by the tone of your voice.
Yeah, and you being nervous, probably they sense that. Mm-hmm. And they might treat you differently than they would treat me, who, you know, I love dogs, Patrick.
Yeah. That's great. You know, we have so much in common. So anyway, there's that. So maybe you're going to get another dog. Is that what you're saying?
No way. No, one. No. One is enough. I don't know how you do two. One is enough.
Well,
but
they're outdoor dogs. But what tell you what.
And less crime, like you said.
There are people all the time who are very hesitant to come to Rancho Madrid to come into the yard because they see those dogs. And they're like, no, we'll wait. So anyway, Frank in Largo, Florida, thank you for holding and welcome.
Good morning, Patrick.
Yes.
Quick thought on the spate of or the increase in mass shootings.
Yeah.
I think it's a couple things. I think, first of all, let's do the math. There's, you know, the population's doubled in the last 20 years or less. Mm-hmm. So there's a doubling of the likelihood of something like this happening.
That's
but
true.
I think the real reason it's happening is if you look at the motives of these mass shooters, increasingly it's all about attention. Mm-hmm. You may very well get the occasional, like what happened in Japan, where there might actually be a political motivation where it's practical and I want to get rid of the candidate because I have a passion about a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's increasingly happening is these kids want to go out in flames. They want to get attention, and the media is bent on basically advancing this anti-gun lobbyist kind of concept. They're more than happy to celebrate the mass shootings and the kids that did it. And these, you know, the kids that are a little bit off, they see this adulation or this negative attention and they want it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think and it's more likely to hit men. I think the other thing I thought was very interesting about what you said was they seem to be men.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, men who are wanting to express themselves out of frustration, you know, men have in their desire, you know, violence and being strong. And so they really want to get that kind of adulation. Whereas women tend to get attention through media, through sexuality and, you know, doing things that get their attention for extreme, you know,
like
womenly
by being
things.
Provocative, being provocative.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, another thing, to your point, I see what you're saying. I really do. Another thing that this brings up in my mind is look at how many of these guys who do the mass shootings brag about it and talk about it on social media before they actually do it. And this is what boggles my mind is that later on the authorities go back and they see this long list in some cases of warning signs, posing with guns and talking about killing people and ideating, as they say. And then they only find it after the fact. And that seems to be a common thread as well, doesn't it?
It does. And you just got to think it's going to, as long as we're having an increase of, so you have an increase of population among that age group and you have lack of fathers. I mean, you touched on that a minute ago, right? Mm-hmm. Lack of father. I'm also not trying to be too humorous, but I don't know what number of these mass shooters have dogs. I'm beginning to wonder don't mean to make light of it, but
that's interesting. So in other words, if they had empathy for an animal, that would help them be more psychologically sound, maybe. And this is something I've heard anecdotally, so I'd have to look at some statistics, but I've also heard that one of the common traits among serial killers, and maybe this is true of mass killers, I don't know, is pornography is one, drugs is another, and also cruelty to animals is another one.
Yes.
Where they kind of get started doing that.
I think you're right. If you were to look at the families and the pets ownership, and I'm not a big advocate of dog ownership, but mm-hmm. I do believe that it's important for people to have an outlet to express empathy and love. And, you know, these kids are typically isolated. You'd think they probably are less likely to have a pet that they're fond of. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what it is. It's just a function of math and getting rid of guns. And like the thing in Japan shows you that. I mean, if you can't get a gun, if you really want to kill somebody, you'll make a gun on your own.
Right.
Or you'll use knives or whatever else. So it's this narrative. I think we have to stop giving attention and adulation. We have to understand these mass shooters are looking to make a splash. They're going to go down and, the guy in Columbine, he wanted to be remembered for that. And
yeah, these guys are
changed that.
These guys are losers, and they feel like, well, I'm always going to be a loser, so maybe I can have my moment of glory. Yeah, that's a good point. Very good point. Thanks for calling in today. More to come right after this quick timeout, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.